Welcome to the backstory on finances and finances in the context of a pandemic in the city of Longmont. My name is Tim Waters, and I have the good fortune of hosting conversations with community leaders, city officials, elected officials, policymakers, activists on topics of interest and relevance to the community. I do this as a volunteer for Longmont Public Media. And today's topic, City of Longmont finances, in most years probably wouldn't be the kind of story that people might be interested in. But this year, I think it's a different story. And here to tell that story are faces that viewers of the backstory are familiar with: Carol Dominguez, city manager, and Jim Golden, longtime chief financial officer for the City of Longmont. So welcome, gentlemen, and thank you for doing this. I know how busy your schedules are. And squeezing this in with all of the other things that you're asked to do. I appreciate it. And I'm certain folks who watch this will appreciate it as well. So Jim, let's start with, we're in the middle of January as we record this. You two fellas, along with a lot of others, put in a ton of work to build a budget for the city. And there's, with accounting for all kinds of different sources of revenue and lots of estimates and the uncertainties with which you have to deal. Just talk about the highlights of that, Jim. What does it take to get us into the first month of the year, having built this budget out? What are the big assumptions? What are the kind of sources of revenues you're anticipating and estimating that roll up into a city budget?
Well, city budget's pretty big. It's about $350 million. And so that's a lot of staff that is involved in putting that together from their perspective of what the needs of the city may be, whether it be operating needs or capital needs for the current year or into the future. So we start our budget process in April or so, actually our CIP process in March of each year, in anticipation on a schedule to bring this all to the city council in the beginning of September and have it adopted according to the city charter in time, so that typically it's adopted by sometime in November at the latest. So it's a big deal, and funding all those sources we need to do from our end of things, besides pulling together all the data we're getting from departments on what their needs and requests are, we do deal with revenues quite a bit to see how we can fund these things. Because we do have to make choices, because there is hardly ever enough revenue to do everything that is going to be requested. So what's critical is for the number one critical item is sales tax. Sales and use tax is our largest revenue item outside of utility fees. But within our general fund and four other major operating funds, sales and use tax is a major revenue driver. So we use that for both operating and capital needs. And so it's pretty critical. We track that, as you know, Tim, we put out reports monthly on the status of our sales and use tax collections. Me and my staff, we watch that carefully. We look for trends, we see what's going on. And what we are typically trying to do is come to the budget process probably in sometime in July. Sometimes it drags or lags a little later because we try to make the last possible decision we can, with an estimate of what we're going to put into that budget for the next year. And so we like I said, we put a lot of time into that. And then whatever that number is pretty critical in driving the overall expenses in the general fund, the streets fund, the public improvement fund. So what we end up doing then, in addition to that, is another big factor is the market pay and cost of pay and benefits. Because that, of course, besides capital projects, that is a very large factor in the city's operating budget, is the cost of salaries and benefits. And that's something that we also have HR working on throughout the second quarter. Basically gathering market data from other entities. That's going to come around to a number that's going to drive the expense side of our budgets as well, and let us know how much we have. If we're going to make market pay, then what will be left over for other needs in the general fund, as well as other major operating funds. So those are two big ones. Property tax is another big revenue source. Sales and use tax is like $80 million, but property tax is $24 million or so. But we have less of a role in projecting that. That's really just coming from the assessor's office every year. So we get that number and work it into our projections as we go through the process during each summer. So those are really the biggest things. Development revenues is another factor. Other smaller revenues, we do go through all of our revenues and make projections, but the sales tax is really going to drive what our budget's going to look like from year to year.
So you get into 2020, you've done all that work. You track it diligently to make certain that your estimates are within plus or minus of what they need to be. So you've got continuity as you go through the year. And before you're through the first quarter of last year, you've got a pandemic. And I'm guessing while you've dealt with disruptions, right? You have had economic slowdowns, you've had the effects of a flood, we've had the Great Recession, we've had all those things, but you've never had to deal with the uncertainties of a pandemic. No one alive has had to do that. So you get into the first quarter of last year, what are some of those recalculations or recalibrations you're having to do before you get through the first quarter of last year? In the impact of what you thought might be the impact of the pandemic on your revenues?
Well, that was come down on us pretty quickly. And we had to try to get a sense of what could be the worst case scenario. And really we had no clue as to what might continue to come in versus what might stop. So, being conservative and trying to make projections for revenue, I took a look at that, and knowing what was open at the time and what we were continuing to see operating within the city is what I really took a look at and said, we're going to count on this coming in, but not at its normal levels. And I may have reduced them down to 75% or something like that. I can't recall exactly what I used. And then the rest of it that I couldn't be sure of, I said, we're not going to get. So, our worst case scenario was our first projection. And that was as high as a $13 million shortfall in sales and use tax. That was, though, thinking that at that point in time, knowing what we didn't know about the pandemic at that point in time, as little as we knew, we were thinking, well, this could go on for a couple of months. And so what we're experiencing today at that point in time, it's going to go on for a couple of months. And then after that, we're hearing there's probably going to be a recession, and we need to put that into our projections as well. And that's kind of how we got to the first estimates. And you said that I track sales tax diligently. Before 2020, I thought I tracked it diligently. But beginning in last spring and, to this day, I track it daily. So I never paid attention to how much comes in every day. But all through that budget process and us trying to decide how much are we going to project that sales tax revenue at, you were watching it come in day by day. And I still do watch. There's still things I continue to do, even though things have turned around from what we were looking at 9 months ago. So
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
So you're in the first quarter of the year. Your chief financial officer, Harold, who is paid to be conservative. That's every chief financial officer in the world. That's, they live, they sleep, eat, being conservative. So you're now from your CFO here, and you're anticipating now pretty substantial shortfalls, right? Jim just is using maybe a 25% loss or shortfall, and what that translates into in terms of dollars. You now have, however, a chance to make decisions with almost no data, right? I mean, you've got that first quarter, but now you're really operating with a whole bunch of uncertainties. What are the kinds of decisions now as a city manager with your team you start to make in anticipation of getting the city through this, where, I mean, you don't have options. You got some reserves, but you don't have options to debt finance your operations like Congress does. You got to make it all work in the year. So what are some of the uncertainties, some of the decisions you were making without a whole lot of data to make them?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I joke with Jim, you know, early in my career, I did a lot of budget and finance work. So I like to dabble in his world occasionally, drive him nuts. I do want to compliment Jim on this as we start off. And you may remember this, I hope Jim does. Early on in this is, so a bit of a backstory to the backstory. As a team, we started talking about this, I want to say in January, when we started seeing it, and we were meeting occasionally, and it ramped up. And when we really started getting into it, you know, it was that this conversation of what do we think this is going to be? What do we think the loss is going to be? Jim actually was, I believe, the first finance director in Boulder County to come forward with a projection, and eventually I think multiple finance directors in the county were calling him to go, how do you do this? How did you move through this? And we knew it was, you know, and this is what I appreciate about Jim, and we knew this was going to be a significant issue for us. And when you get that number, you kind of just, it's a pause like I think I've never experienced, because what you also have to then figure out is, so what do we do? Because it's in times like these that you really need the operations of the organization to be there to support the community, because you don't know what issues are going to come at you. You then also have to think about the lives of the people who work in the organization and how this is going to impact them. And so it created a lot of really difficult conversations. And the thing that I think, looking back on it, a lot of cities did a lot of different things. But, you know, we started off to say, if we could just capture everything that we have in terms of capital projects, you know, dollars that we can really control to say, we're just not going to do it this year. What does that look like? And then Jim was giving me some analysis in terms of the various fund balances that we have. And, you know, just sort of pulling this thing together to say, here's how we can try to start managing the gap. And then almost immediately we put in a hiring freeze and really just held on a lot of those discretionary expenditures. And what that let us do then is really then also start looking at the operational pieces of this. You know, a lot of people know, and we didn't call a furlough as early as some folks did. I think that was, and Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, those were very conscious conversations that we were having to go, do we need to do this? If so, when do we have this conversation? And then let's watch the data as it's coming in. So it was a really data-informed decision as we were moving through. And that was also about, we knew we needed the people to be there when we came out of this. So we were just moving through all of these different things, trying to then dictate operations in terms of what we needed to do and repurposing folks. And, you know, it's a long story, but it was probably it was the most challenging, because he modeled off of the 08 recession. None of us knew how people were going to respond to this. We've never closed every business in our community for, what was it, Jim, 2 months?
Month and a half or more?
You know, and our conversation was, this number is predicated on a 2-month closure. If it goes beyond that, it's going to be different. And so those were things, as these rules started becoming more strict and adjusting, he's watching and he's telling us and he's coming through. And we were literally discussing it on a daily basis, trying to make daily decisions that we felt first and foremost was in the best interest of our community. Second, allowed us to continue to provide the services that we needed to our community during this time. And third, really respect the position where the staff, or the members of our staff, the positions they were in and the impacts as we were moving through this. So it was, I probably moved around in a circle, but it was a tough process.
Well, I think that's an important part of the story, frankly. I mean, everybody would be easy under the conditions under which everybody's been operating. You could just assume, right? Yeah, there are a bunch of hard decisions that have to be made. But the calculations, the consideration of where your priorities are and what kind of capacity do you need to maintain, so when you get to the other side of this, number one, you can deliver services through it and you've got capacity on the other side to ramp back up, right, to meet expectations. I mean, those are tough and serious decisions. And, you know, when they affect people's livelihoods, it's a big deal. In fact, I think it's important for some people to understand, there were cities around Longmont that early in the pandemic, they started laying people off. Not just hiring freezes. We didn't have to do that. And I know there were questions that some people asked about, well, why are we laying people off if Broomfield is laying people off or Boulder's laying people off?
Those questions, Harold and I were having those conversations quite frequently. Every time that one of those things were announced at another entity, we kept looking at each other. You know, there's a few things that we're factoring in here that maybe we're not factoring elsewhere. And keep in mind, there were, you mentioned some of those communities. There are a lot of other communities that didn't have to do cuts. We're not unique. I don't want to say that we're unique, because the reality is we relied on some reserves. And a lot of entities do have those type of reserves. It was how much impact was their communities going through, though, and whether they could deal with those or not. We had not hired our seasonal workers. And so we did not have to let them go. And those are furloughs elsewhere. And so that's a bit of a difference there. We just never did put those people on the payroll because of the timing there. Others had already gone that far. We had the benefit. Well, first of all, we do have some pretty decent reserves. We still try to continue to reach higher reserve levels that we have as targets. But we did have a stability reserve of $1.7 million. And that was in our general fund, I mean. And that was something that we intended for, I don't want to say a pandemic, but a reduction in revenues. Yeah. So whether it be an economic downturn of some point of some kind that would reduce our revenues. So this really fell right into that reasoning. We thought, well, we've got $1.7 million here in the general fund. Now we were looking at a general fund shortfall of as high of 10.6 million. So that's just a help, right? We also though had the luck that we have had been building up this reserve for OPEB. It's other post-employment benefits, and it's a commitment that actuarially we were being told we needed to put away for. And it involves our retirees and the fact that they get to purchase, those who retire before age 65 can purchase the city's insurance, and they're buying it at the city's cost. So in a sense, that's a discount. So that's a cost that we're covering for them in a sense. Well, we were told 10, 12 years ago that by the accounting changes in accounting requirements that we needed to start putting money away for that. And it didn't quite make sense to me even back then, but it turned out that, you know, we were paying as we were going. And we were just paying that expense year after year. So I kept questioning, so when am I ever going to take money out of this reserve? new auditors, new actuaries all come into place a little over a year ago. And what they point out to us is, you know what, you don't need this. And you can take that reserve and take it off your books. So we said, let's put it back where it came from. And so the general fund ended up getting over $2 million of a basically a rebate of money it had been putting over into that fund over the last 10 years. Between that and the stability reserve, we had almost $4 million as a starting point. And when we also had put $2.5 million of one-time expense in that 2020 budget towards the first and main transit station. We had fund balance available at the end of 19. We used that in our budgeting process to help fund that project. We put on hold. And so we said, well, you know what? That's unfunded now. And so that got us up to $6.5 million of potential fallback. So that only put us in a position where we needed to start to identify $3.5 million of reductions in our 2020 operating budget for the general fund. And so we did keep looking at each other going, is it time? Do we need to do this? But we're like, well, we've got this fallback. And then month after month, we began to realize that our projections, at least from a sales tax perspective, were too high. We kept reducing them as the shortfall that we were experiencing was nowhere near what we had projected. We did have other areas that we were going to incur shortfalls for. And so that was over and above those sales tax projections. And the general fund, and like I said, at one point was as high as a $10.6 million shortfall projection. But that was like at the end of May that we said that. And probably from that point forward, we began to notice that this sales tax is not coming in as short anywhere near as what the conservative CFO thought it was going to come in at. And that was to our benefit.
Well, I think too, if I can add to this, you almost have to go back to the budget year before this. When Jim talked about the allocation of funds to some of the capital projects, what you may remember as part of that conversation is we had extra ongoing revenue that we said we want to put to one-time funds and hold because A, we knew it wasn't going to be a reappraisal year. Right, yeah. And B, we were afraid—
For property tax purposes.
For property taxes. B, we were afraid there was going to be a recession based on some of the economic indicators that we were seeing.
So remember those conversations.
Dollars that Jim just referred to, it was actually in that decision to say, we're not going to put it in ongoing funding. We're going to put it in one-time funding, but then made it really easy to say, we're going to unfund those projects. And then that folds then into, while he's doing this, we then immediately are jumping into building the budget for next year. Again, with a lot of information that we just don't really have a full grasp on based on a pandemic that is new to all of us.
Jim, you made reference to being lucky when you were talking about the, is it the OPED fund?
OPED.
And I would say that, I don't know whose definition it is, but someone's definition was shared with me along the way of good luck is the intersection of preparation and opportunity, right? So you make your own good luck. You had prepared for it, and you executed when you had to. So yeah, good on you for the good luck that arrived at the right time. So you get into the year, Harold was just, both of you referred to the monitoring sales tax revenues that continued to materialize. Talk a little bit about what you know. Jim, you made reference earlier to not every city was affected the same way, right? Not every city had to make cuts. Because it has the pandemic has had a very differential effect in cities. Some of them are far more affected than others. So what are your explanations for that? Why is that some have been affected more deeply financially than others?
Well, you know, as far our sales tax, it started to decline as soon as the pandemic hit. I mean, that even February sales tax which was due in March 20th, even that was down. And the reason being because some businesses were not making that payment on the 20th of March. So we saw that drop, and we then turned around and started going, now that the stores are closing and now that everything is shutting down, it's going to get much worse. So we made those large projections. March sales tax was actually up 6%. And that was a shocker to us. But as you recall, you know, as soon as the pandemic hit, everyone made the run to the stores to buy the provisions and things. And that really gave us that boost in March. But in April, sales tax was down 12.7%. And that's where everyone's sales tax, everyone was seeing the same thing happen. They had a little bit of boost and then the bottom fell out. So we just didn't know how far, you know, how far is the floor here?
What was the bottom? Yeah.
How much worse will it get? And yeah, we of course made some conservative projections. You know, come to find out now over time, a lot of other entities in Boulder County did much better than what they had projected. You mentioned Boulder, I think Denver as well, are two entities, of course, that we've heard a lot about how they've had to do significant cuts and that they've had large reductions in their sales tax revenues. And you know, you get back, you don't hear the term bedroom community as much anymore, right? Yeah. Well, but you know, I think this is a big factor in these cities that didn't have as much of a revenue impact, because a lot of people commute to work in Boulder, a lot of people commute to work in Denver. And when they're there, they spend money. They spend money during the day or when their work day is over before they go back to wherever they live, they're spending money in those two cities. And a lot of that went away. For Boulder, the university went away. And so those factors made a big difference in their sales tax declines. Boulder doesn't have as much big box, obviously, as Longmont does. And that's another factor for why they suffered, had larger losses than other entities did. And we've got the big boxes and we've got people who were staying here and working from home here and not leaving town and going spending their money elsewhere, whether it be because that's where they used to work or now they're working in Longmont, or whether they were just leaving town to go shopping, you know, at Costco, which we know that people in Longmont do, but yeah, probably stopped doing during the pandemic. And we also know that they leave town to go eat sometimes, but they certainly didn't do that either during the pandemic. And so we were benefiting by the fact that everyone was basically tied to Longmont.
Yeah.
And continuing to have to eat, have to get by the things they need to live. Some things stopped and went away. Automobile sales went away for like 2 months. It just pretty much nothing coming from that source. But those big box stores kept us going. And our restaurants, they certainly didn't do the type of business that they were doing pre-pandemic, but people did still stay and still purchase and keep most of those restaurants in play.
Yeah.
I think to that point, you know, the interesting story here is, I remember us talking about this, probably the first time we've ever really seen, you know, you hear us talk about leakage of sales tax dollars. Jim and I talked about this, we've seen it where we've had almost no leakage because people were kept within the community. And so the dollars were still circulating there. You know, to his point about the big box, you know, when I talked to my colleagues, that was something that we all discussed. And I think it's important to really talk about that's the benefit of having a diverse local economy. I think those communities that had a more diverse local economy are the communities that you're tending to see that didn't have the same impacts of those that are solely dependent on tourism or dependent on universities that don't necessarily have that diversity in their retail. I think that was a big component on this. But the other thing that I think was incredibly important was really the people that lived in our community and their support of local businesses. And whether it's going to the stores that remain open, any number of stories of people going to hardware stores, nurseries, but staying local to do that, what was important, but then also supporting the local restaurants and retail that were doing stuff with pickup and drive-through. They really supported those businesses, but also supported us by keeping that revenue in there. And so there's a big thank you on that one.
That is an important part of the story. People need to know that wasn't just rhetoric. That translated into some surviving, and at the end of the day, the city being able to continue to deliver services. That's a big part of the story. We're now middle of January when we're recording this. So Jim, talk about where are we now in terms of the kind of estimating you're doing going forward. What types of revenues still have not kind of materialized or rebounded the way they will eventually? And how do we account for that? And then what are the implications that residents ought to understand?
Well, first of all, with the sales tax, since that's the number one revenue, my projections were horrible, right? So they were nowhere near reality. So as it turned out, we are probably going to end this year. And I only know right now through November, because December results will come in during the month of January. But through the month of November, we're probably up around 3.8% over the previous year. Our budget was 2.9% increase or so. So we are actually exceeding the budget that we had for sales tax for 2020. And I'm sure that we will stay above the budget level with only a month to go. So that's finished well. Sales tax, hopefully, especially since our projections for 21 were again somewhat conservative, because we made them all the way back in July when we were still projecting shortfalls. So we would have to have a decline, and a large decline, to actually not meet budget. So we're in a good position from that perspective. But other revenues, they still suffered. And anything that was tied to a service that was not fully available as it was pre-pandemic, and then maybe had a user charge attached to it, that really did have an impact. And in the general fund, we still did have at least $4 million of shortfall from revenues impacted, say, by the pandemic. We had a few other revenues that just didn't come in as budgeted for other purposes, non-pandemic related, but at least a $4 million shortfall from revenues that didn't come in because we did not offer our services at the fullest level. So, and recreation is, over 75% of that number. We do also have other revenues tied to the museum really had a large shortfall in revenues compared to their budget, at least. And then fees for disconnects, we stopped shutting off our utility service for our customers. And so there's revenues connected to that, but there's also costs that went away there as well. So that one didn't hurt us as much. We were able to reduce costs in these services that were shut down or not offered, that was offsetting that revenue shortfall. But we couldn't entirely do that for recreation and museum. And so we had large shortfalls there. our court revenues or fine revenues from anything, whether it be parking, library fines. Obviously, these things weren't happening during the pandemic, so we had a reduction in all those as well. So they all make up the $4 million, and those haven't stopped yet. I mean, we have to expect to see that again in 21. We did build our budgets a bit more conservative with an expectation that this would roll over into 21 to some degree, but I don't think if we're sitting here saying that we're not going to be fully vaccinated before at least halfway through the year or later, that's not how we projected our revenues. And so we still have challenges in front of us with 21 revenues, not potentially meeting budget either.
And from the same types of sources, from recreation activities, the museum, those right. kinds of things, they're really fee-based, right? I mean, the revenues that are generated through fees and fines.
Right.
And so Harold, talk about some of the specific examples, because I know there'll be interest in the whatever the it is, right? Whichever program is someone's particular interest, and wanting to see it back to normal, or you know, fully operational, or on the schedule they're accustomed to. What are some of the examples where people just need to understand those are not funded, those programs not funded with tax dollars, and until their activity resumes, there won't be revenue generation.
Yeah, so I think to go back to kind of set the stage for this and talk about what Jim pointed out, when we went into the budget and presented it to council, essentially what we projected, and this was done in conjunction with with Jeff Friesner and our recreation group, I think we projected a 25% reduction in revenue in recreation services. And so they did a 25% reduction sort of across the recreation sector. And then we did a 30% reduction in the hours for our temporary staff members. So if you go back when we talked about we didn't have to do furloughs and things, we were still paying those individuals, but we knew going into 21, we couldn't continue that based on that revenue structure coming in. And so what does that mean? Well, that means when we're now covering operations with our full-time staff members in different venues and a combination of some of the temporary staff members at the reduced hours. But if you look at things like the hours that we can operate the rec centers, how many people we can have in there. Now there's two drivers in this and they're both playing with each other. So one driver is what are we allowed to do based on the health orders that are in place at the time and how robust can our operations really be? Going into the end of the year, we actually were allowing more people in until we saw the spike in cases, and then they backed off of that. So in many cases, we went from approximately 50% to 25%. So we're now able to have less people in facilities, which then reduces that revenue stream. And the best example in this, and there's a lot of questions on it, was our hockey rink. We have to prepare a month ahead of time so that we can open it in October. Based on what we were seeing on the numbers, we felt comfortable on the financial analysis that at 50% occupancy, we would be okay. So we start doing that work. It changes and we go to 25%.
Yeah.
We really had a long conversation of do we even open it or do we not open it? We said, well, we don't want to lose what we've invested. People need an outdoor recreation opportunity. But as we look into 21, based on how we structure the budget, we don't have the coverage that we do in 20. So remember, it was open in October, November, and December, and that fell within that budget. But we knew in 21, into January was probably all we could absorb. And so that's how we talked about that issue, because those user fees really come into play. And so if you keep going and you keep losing, and then we know that many of the recreation programs probably are going to be fully operational until much later in the year, which is going to create a more difficult situation because we projected potentially an earlier opening that starts feeding. So that's that other deficit. And we're going to have to continue evaluating this to the point. What we said is when we set some of these, when we set the budget, as orders change and we have the ability to open up, we will then get together, assess the revenue stream, assess what we can do, but then we actually have to come back in the budget process, adjust the revenue projections potentially, and adjust the expenditures so we can open up. So it's not an immediate switch that we can flip as we have opportunities, because we still have this broader budget pressure in place. And I'm focusing on rec, but there are other areas where this exists. Jim, did I miss anything or misstate anything?
No, you didn't. But I think what I need to add in is that, you know, so I talked about how our sales tax ended the year. I think the fact that between that, as well as the fact that we were able to save a lot of expenditures in the general fund from our operating expenses as well, we were able to withstand the reductions that we had in mostly the recreation revenues and the other revenues, the 4 million plus of shortfall that I was talking about. Probably we used up, I would imagine, and I won't know all this for sure until we close out the end of the year in a couple of months or so, but we probably used up that OPEB reserve, but we would not have touched the stability reserve. And in fact, during the budget process, we did add another $1.4 million to that stability reserve. So it's now over $3 million stability reserve. We've got that. We were able to also refund the First and Main Transit Station, right? And any of these other capital projects that we had unfunded or put on hold, they've all either been funded again or rebudgeted for 2021. So we've really been able to take care of those things and didn't have the hurt that we thought that we were gonna have. So I don't wanna say that, yeah, we're gonna come up, we have these revenue shortfalls that we're gonna have from these services, but there are fallbacks now that we had last year. We don't have that OPEB anymore, but we do have a larger stability reserve. We do have capital projects. Again, we're still in a position to be able to deal with things. And that's, you know, that's something that we have in our hand, in our pocket, that we know going forward. Things have to get a lot worse for us to be in dire straits.
Yeah, well, part of the story is the stewardship that you're describing now, and how there were kind of responsibility that you two have assumed for making certain that all those funds are managed. The reserves are conservative enough that they're there in the hard times, and to restore a number of the projects that you've referred to. For me, it's kind of a good news, bad news, and cautionary tale. Right. The good news is sales taxes have continued to materialize, and many of the city's operations funded that way. Kind of bad news is you're still going to have to struggle to bring back up to kind of pre-pandemic levels some of the fee-funded activities, recreation, museum, et cetera. And then the cautionary tale, and this is maybe how we'll close it out, there's still uncertainties you're managing as you anticipate. Jim or Harold, one of you made reference to the speculation about a recession. You still got a lot of uncertainty that you're managing. So talk a bit about what that is in 2021 and anything else that Longmonters ought to hear from you two about city finances and what to anticipate or maybe to be looking for or listening for as the year unfolds.
I'll let Jim go first and then I'll go.
Does anyone really look forward to city finances?
I don't know. I've been in these conversations with you for a lot of hours. You're more animated in this conversation today. I love it. So there'll be some people who are interested.
You know, I think I have too much new to add to what I've said. I think we're in a strong position because of the fact that sales tax projection or budget, I should say, for 2021 is below our 2020 actual. So that's a good thing. We should be able to easily surpass that budget, hopefully, if everything stays well and we continue along seeing what we've seen to this point. We should do a good job of surpassing that. It's just the services that are fee-based that will continue to be on limited use or on hold until this passes. A golf fund had a record year, though.
Yeah, shows you one thing people could do, and they did a lot of it. So
that's actually a pandemic impact, actually.
It is, yeah.
Well, and it's interesting how if because they didn't have the same limits, they were able to do really well versus outdoor where it did have limits, they were actually restrained in this.
Yeah, the pandemic across the country has been probably has fueled more golf activity across the country than anything right. else could have besides Tiger Woods, right, to have fueled golf. Right.
Actually, what's interesting is when we look at it, we've outperformed the Tiger Woods. I mean, the Tiger Woods. Yeah. Were actually seen as the peak.
Yeah.
We outperformed that as we looked at the numbers. Yeah. I think one of the things that I would say, so we still have demands that I don't think we fully understood, but we knew were potentially there. So when we talk about things like, how do we support the Boulder County Health Department and how we work together too? Bring forward a five-star program that none of us even had a clue was going to exist is that we need to support so that can support our local businesses and how can we repurpose folks? How can we potentially support vaccine operations as those continue to develop? How do we handle the needs that exist within our community that are the result of the pandemic? And you can see it in our business assistance grants and repurposing people and utility assistance and what's that going to look like as we continue to move forward and people are. So there's a component of this on services and what do we provide. On the other side of it, it's what's the world like today? And we have a better sense of what we can expect via the pandemic. You know, Jim and I, what we also didn't say is, you know, man, if we get to another shutdown, who's going to survive it?
Yeah.
What's that going to look like? Who knows? And then unfortunately, you just see the state of the world or the state of the United States today. And I don't think any of us can answer, you know, clearly what is the potential economic impact of what we're seeing right now and how is that going to impact us as an organization and a community? Those are all things that you still have to keep in your mind and we have to continue being diligent to try to go, what is the future going to look like in a time that no one's experienced? And that's the challenge that we have. And I'm lucky that Jim's here.
You know, I would say one thing, if this had happened 3 or 4 years ago, when we were not receiving the level of internet sales tax that we are today, I mean, in the sense of, we were not receiving it from the providers. They didn't have to register with us. They didn't have to pay us. And a lot of that's changed in the past few years and is actually even getting better going forward. So we were really bailed out by the fact that we were receiving sales tax from internet sales activity because there was a ton of it going on and still continues to be all the way through that pandemic. And I think that, you know, if there are entities that didn't have those agreements, say with Amazon, and we're not having, a lot of the places that have a nexus here, we're doing sales over the internet too. And so we were receiving that as well. That they lost out if they didn't have those things. And we did, and we, our internet sales activity was up like 150% or something. And we're looking ahead with what the council did last summer, getting us involved in the state's internet portal that will allow out-of-state businesses that do internet business to actually just pay one entity instead of every home rule city in Colorado will hopefully make it so that those businesses are using that portal to pay Longmont and all the cities in Colorado for the sales they make in our cities. And that might even give us even greater internet sales tax.
Well, and I think I'm going to add one more thing if it's okay.
Sure, yeah.
I think the other thing too that I know we've talked about is again, when you hear me talk about a diverse local economy, I think because we had a Smucker's producing Uncrustables, we still had folks coming into Longmont to work, because what was interesting, that product, the demand for that product zoomed in the pandemic, and they were having to put, I think, their people on distribution amount. Avexis, I know they were continuing to work and bring people in. So when you talk about a diverse local economy, you have to also talk about those components that have come in, where people weren't going to work in certain communities. Some were still coming to work in our community because of the employment opportunities here. And so the broad, diverse local economy, I think, was also an important piece of what we experienced.
And we all know that the economic development efforts are not going to stop. You're going to continue to do the recruitment of primary employers, and obviously the success rate has been pretty impressive. So part of the backstory here, as far as I'm concerned, for Longmonters, is just how well these resources have been stewarded. There is no luck here. You guys, the finances are in good hands. The city and the community are fortunate to have people of your experience and your talent and your expertise, because if you guys don't get it right with this part of the operation, nothing else is going to work. So thanks for sharing the story today. More importantly, thanks for what you do day in and day out in your roles and in your selfless service to this community as the city manager and the chief financial officer. So Longmonters, that is your backstory on City of Longmont finances in the hopefully soon post-pandemic and post-pandemic era. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.